My wife and I decided to take a couple of weeks after the feast to visit a couple of different islands. I had heard good things about Maui, and so it was quite different than the Big Island, but it was very enjoyable. But we wanted to save Kauai as our last stop on this Hawaiian adventure. Several people had told us that it was their favorite island, and we wanted to end up on Kauai. So when we got off the plane, we were actually met at the airport by a couple of friends, Dan and Tina Roop, who is the mother and father of Amanda, who was, of course, Greg's wife. And Mr. Roop informed us, it's actually interesting, we flew with them over to Oahu, to Honolulu, and then they went to Maui, and then we went to Kauai. No, they went to Kauai, and we went to Maui. And so anyhow, we saw them when they were leaving Kauai as we were getting there. But Mr. Roop informed me that they'd lost the internet on the whole island. I didn't know that was possible, but it certainly was. And so evidently their service by one provider, and reportedly the cable had become severed, and they lost the whole internet. So thankfully it didn't affect flights going out for the Roops or incoming flights for us as we arrived there. And I had saved the last place to be the most enjoyable. I rented a small condo because I wanted to end up on a positive note. So upon picking up our car at the airport, or around the airport there, we headed off to our condo. Now, the temperatures during those first 3 weeks was above normal. It was very warm on the Big Island in Maui. It was about 90 degrees. And on Kauai, it turned out to be in the upper 80s. It was a little lower, but with the high humidity where we were staying at Pu'ipu, spelled P-O-I-P-U, but it's pronounced Pu'ipu, where we were staying there, the humidity made up for the lesser temperatures. So when we arrived, the unit was quite hot due to the above average temperatures this year. And as I searched the walls for a thermostat, I ran across three big, tall, oscillating fans and a little table fan similar to the one behind me here. And I couldn't find the thermostat. And I began to wonder, do we have air conditioning? So I called the owner, and sure enough, she confirmed, no, there's not any air conditioning in your unit or the whole complex for that matter. And usually if it was a normal year and it hadn't been above normal, it would probably have been all right. So we thought about moving to a different locality because it was quite hot in the unit, but when you don't have able to book ahead, it's even more expensive. So at this point, we decided to open up the louvers on the front door. That explained why there were louvers on the front door. And we went to open up the door in the back, and the screen wouldn't stay connected. And we were on the ground floor, and so I wasn't that fond of leaving the door open all night anyway, because somebody could just cut with a knife the screen. And so we were going to have to deal with that because the lock was broken, so we decided, well, we'll just make the best of the current situation. So we started hooking up fans, and two of the four fans did not work. So here we found ourselves in Kauai, the Garden Isle, this supposedly paradise with no air conditioning, no way of creating a good breeze once we close the doors to the condo there. The internet was out on the whole island, so we really, you couldn't entertain yourself that evening or watch any television. Of course, it's dependent upon the same cable, and so there was no TV. And since none of my modern gadgets were working, I decided to do a little reading about the island while Rita was unpacking in the bedroom. Now, the bedroom had a nice, rustic type of set, a bedroom set in it, but it had rails around the bed, and they were covered by this, and they were very high. And Rita said, you got to be careful, because I've already hit myself three times, and some bruises actually came on her leg over the next few days. So when I went to unpack, I was careful at first, but guess what? I forgot about those, and I ran my shin into this bed, and it took some skin off. In fact, the scab finally came off this a couple of days ago. But anyhow, I forgot about these man-eating boards and was injured. I actually thought and said some things I had to repent of. So the first night on Kauai did not turn out so well. Kauai had not turned out to be the precious gem that I thought it was going to. And with all the disappointments of the day, we decided to turn in so that we could have a better day tomorrow. And we did finally manage to fall asleep in this hot unit. But then about 3 o'clock in the morning, we heard this. Over and over and over again. 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I guess in 1982 and 92, they had a couple hurricanes over in the Hawaiian Islands, and all the chicken houses were overturned. And there are chickens on Kauai everywhere. They mated with the red jungle fowl that are on the island, brought it there purposefully by the Polynesians. And anyhow, the chickens truly rule the roost. They are everywhere. We ate across the street, and they were all under our table and just waiting for us to drop something like vultures. I mean, they are everywhere. Where's Colonel Sanders when you need him? And as I lay there once again being awake, you know, hearing these roosters crying, I began to contemplate a number of different things. I was frustrated at myself for not ensuring that this fine condo had air conditioning. Somehow I had missed this when I got it. I was frustrated at the things were broken, the broken screen door that we couldn't lock, the fans were broken, the internet was out, the TVs didn't work. I was still in pain in my leg from having hit this man-eating board. I was annoyed that the roosters were crowing and not letting me get back to sleep, crowing at the top of their lungs, at the top of their gizzards, or whatever roosters crow from. And as I lay there, hot, frustrated, and annoyed, I remembered a message that I gave in Henderson about a month before the feast. It was entitled, "If you're ever going to see a rainbow, you got to stand a little rain." That sermon was based on a book by Paul Stoltz. He wrote this book called Adversity Quotient, and Turning Obstacles into Opportunities. Dr. Schultz has been regarded as a motivational speaker for many, many years. He's the current CEO of Peak Industries. They go into a number of different businesses and work with them in universities, teaching them how to deal with adversity. And in the beginning of his book, Dr. Stoltz asked some interesting questions. Why do some people fail given the same opportunity as another individuals while others succeed? You know, for years, the common measure of one's potential was their IQ. And while it's obvious that intelligence is an asset, it is by no means the determining factor on whether someone is going to be successful or not. Anyone with an IQ greater than 140 is considered to be a high IQ. Both Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking has IQ or had IQs of about 160 or so. But Ted Kaczynski also had a high IQ. It was actually higher than theirs, about 167 or 168. And yet he became disgruntled in life. He used his intelligence to be able to plant bombs strategically that he couldn't be caught. He evaded the law for 17 years. And he became to be known as the world's Unabomber. So intelligence alone, IQ, is not a true measure of a person's potential for success. Dr. Stoltz maintains that a person's ability to succeed is tied to his AQ, to his adversity quotient. He says that successful people have the ability to prevail in spite of adversity. You know, all successful people at one time or another are knocked down, but they have the ability to prevail, to be able to get back up. They get back up when they're knocked down and refuse to quit. They have an amazing resiliency. Thomas Edison was considered a dunce by his grade school teacher. And on page 18, Dr. Stoltz records this about Thomas Edison. So the famous story of Thomas Edison, who took more than 20 years and 50,000 experiments to invent a light, durable, efficient battery for use as an independent power source, tells us someone questioning his route, he said, "Mr. Edison, you failed 50,000 times. What makes you think you're ever going to get any results?" To which Edison replied, "Results? I've got lots of results. I've got 50,000 results. I know 50,000 things that don't work." But Edison shed light on the true meaning of persistence. He had a high adversity quotient. He knew how to get back up when he'd fall down in failure. He tried and tried until he succeeded. Dr. Paul Stoltz appears to be a mountain climber, or at least he's familiar with the process of mountain climbing. He uses the analogy of a group of people starting to climb up this high mountain, and when the weather changes, the climbing begins to become difficult. There's three different categories that people fall into. The first category is quitters. When the wind gets howling and the temperature takes a nosedive on that mountain, the air gets thin, between 5 and 10% just quit. He said, "I've had enough. This is not for me." And they head back down the mountain. Another 70 to 80% are listed as campers. They say, "Let's just set up camp and let's hunker down until things improve." They set up a tent, and then they settle in and they wait to see if there's a break in the weather. They begin to exchange challenge for security and comfort. They may be at all different stages of life, but they're no longer striving. They just want to be secure and comforted. And then Dr. Stoltz asserts that about 10% of the people can be classified as climbers. They keep on going through the adversity. They keep on stretching and striving to go onward and forward. They have a positive attitude. Fulfillment is achieved by the relentless dedication to the ascent, sometimes slow, painful step by slow, painful step. But scaling the mountain is an indescribable experience, one that only fellow mountain climbers can fully appreciate and understand. Amid the relief, the satisfaction, the exhaustion is a sense of accomplishment, a sense of joy, and peace is rarefied as the mountain air. On the big island of Hawaii, the trip down to Nakalile Bloho was most enjoyable. It was a little over half a mile down and a half a mile back. I think the round trip was about 1.25 miles. And so Rita and I decided to do that. And you had to climb down rocks and step off of rocks. And going down was quite challenging. So to ensure that you didn't fall, but coming back up was even more challenging because it was uphill. It was quite a cliff that you had to climb down. But it was a great adventure. Not only did we get a good workout, but we had a great sense of achievement and accomplishment. You know, only the climber will taste the sweet success. Those who stay in the camp may be justified as being warmer and safer, but they never feel the purpose of being alive or being able to have accomplished something. This brings a great deal of joy in one's life when we accomplish things. Success can be defined to the degree as one moving upward and onward in one's long mission despite all the obstacles and all the other forms of adversity that come upon us. So the good news is that we can't do much to improve our IQ, but we can improve our AQ, our adversity quotient. You know, the people that God has used throughout the years to make a significant contribution and to further His work weren't necessarily mental giants. They weren't the most brilliant or the most talented, but they all did have, the ones that succeeded and went on and will be in the kingdom, had an extremely high adversity quotient. They had amazing resiliency. They refused to quit when the weather got bad. They weren't satisfied with just hunkering down and being campers. They were climbers, and they continued to climb up that ascent. They kept on going. You know, the Bible mentions in several places, don't grow weary in well-doing, don't lose heart. Finish the race, keep pressing toward the goal, be faithful unto death. And as Christians, there's a couple of factors, I think, that should make us more of a climber than non-believers. First of all, of course, we have the motivation for the kingdom of God. This should be reviewed in our mind on a daily basis so that we don't forget it, especially as we encounter tests and trials in this life. We will inherit incorruption if we don't give up, if we press forward. And the second is that we have God's Spirit to help us and to motivate us along life's journey. You know, God's Spirit, as we understand, doesn't force us to do things, but if we follow God's Spirit, it always ends up well. When we always follow God's Spirit, it always ends up well. It creates conviction in our lives to do things because they are the right things to do. So when we yield to God's Spirit, it always leads us in the right direction. It leads us toward the crest of the hills, the top of the mountain, if you will. Spirit of God can keep us going. It can motivate us. Interestingly, Dr. Stoltz even mentions that one's faith can be a measure of our AQ, our adversity quotient. Well, the title for the message today is Coping with Adversity. I won't use the, if you're ever going to see a rainbow, you've got to stand a little rain because those who had to do the disc down in Henderson were faithful about putting that on that disc. And so anyhow, it's called Coping with Adversity. You know, as we go through life, it's common for our parade or our picnic to get rained on. Dr. Stoltz has devised the test to measure your AQ in this book, but there's an abbreviated test that you can take. But I'd like to cover the lessons of three of God's people. All three of these individuals met enough adversity that it would have caused a lot of people to quit. At least most people would have camped or stalled, at least set up camp. But these individuals that we will be covering kept on climbing. They reached the mountain peak of achievement from God's perspective. There are three well-known characters in the Bible. You're already familiar with their lives. But I'd like to approach it from a little different perspective. Let's look at the cause, what caused the adversity in their lives. Because in all three cases, it was something different. A different reason caused their particular adversity. First example is Joseph. He had a high adversity quotient. He turned his obstacles into opportunities. He kept on climbing when things got bad in his life, in spite of the adversity. So as we go through the mini study, if you will, of three of God's people, of these individuals, I want to establish three different sources of adversity. Three sources of adversity. The first one is this. Point number one, adversity can come when people let you down. Adversity can come when people let you down. Joseph experienced disappointment with people over and over and over again. He came from an unstable family by some people's standards. Today, people would probably refer to it as being dysfunctional. Joseph was the son of Rachel, Jacob's favorite wife, and Rachel died when Joseph was very young. Notice Genesis chapter 35. Genesis 35, beginning verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when they came to a little entrance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had a hard labor. And it came to pass, Genesis 35 and verse 17 now, and it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have the son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died. But she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So we find that Joseph's wife Rachel died a little bit after having Ben-Oni, as she called him. And this was Joseph's only full brother. Rachel called him Ben-Oni, which means the son of my sorrow. The son of my sorrow. She was going to have him, and then she was not going to be around to rear him. His father, Jacob, called him Benjamin. If you check the margin, it means the son of the right hand. Rachel had indeed been Jacob's right hand. He loved her very much. She was the love of his life. But her death not only impacted Jacob, but also the rest of the family, including young Joseph. Now, in time, Jacob began to let Joseph down. And ironically, he did this by loving Joseph more than the others. This created problems. Genesis 37 and verse 3. Genesis 37 and verse 3. Now Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. So Jacob meant well, but this favoritism to Joseph caused a lot of problems. So Jacob not only let Joseph down by thinking this way, but by publicly displaying it in front of his other brothers. Seemingly, Jacob didn't try to conceal his favoritism. And in verse 4, you can see the problems. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him, Joseph, more than his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So the first person that let Joseph down was his own father. This put him at a disadvantage. And as a result, Joseph was further let down by the rest of his family. He had 10 other brothers, half-brothers, in this blended family, if you will, and they became extremely envious of Joseph. And they became hateful and even violent, if you will. And one day, Jacob did Joseph another injustice by asking him to go out and check the fields, check the status of the fields. And apparently Jacob either tolerated this hate of his sons, or he did not perceive things as they truly were. He didn't see how his favoritism caused a breach in his family. You know, it's tragic when we lose the perspective of reality. Mr. Willoughby talked about this last night in Friday Night Live. What is your reality? Was the section that was on, and he covered some good points. But out in the world, Satan has played his cards well with too many, even in the church. People get upset with the leadership sometimes when they have to deal in tough love. Leaders always have to be looking for good in the long run instead of the short-term good, if you will, sometimes. And sometimes it ruffles people's feathers. But Jacob sends Joseph off to check on his brothers and his flocks. And in verse 18, his brothers see him coming, and then chapter 37 and verse 18, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill Joseph. So Reuben intervenes in verse 22, and instead of killing him, they end up throwing him into a pit in verse 24. Then in verse 27, come and let us sell him, Joseph, to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brothers listened, so the Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph off to Egypt. So at age 17 or so, Joseph is carted away to a foreign land. He probably didn't speak the language. He was totally alone. What a horrible experience that it must have been for this young teenager. So his brothers not also let him down. First it was his father, showing him favoritism, causing friction in the family, and then his brothers sold him off as a slave. Over in Genesis chapter 39, we'll pick up the story, and Joseph had been taken in verse 1 down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. But the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of the master, his Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. Because of Joseph's stellar attitude, because of Joseph's AQ, if you will, his adversity quotient, God prospered Joseph. You know, Joseph didn't wallow in self-pity. He set his mind, if I'm going to be a slave, I'm going to be the best slave that I can be. He didn't quit. He didn't camp. He continued to climb upward, to ascend. He didn't give up, but he made his mind up that he would continue to go forward. And God blessed him for that effort. He came to have rule over all of Potiphar's house. And then in verse 7 of the same chapter, Potiphar's wife let Joseph down. She tried to coerce him into sleeping with her. And when he refused, she evidently felt scorn. So she retaliates and she tells her husband, Potiphar, a untrue story of the account of what really happened. And then Potiphar disappoints Joseph. He lets Joseph down by not believing him and by throwing him into prison. So Joseph's master, in verse 20, took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph. Once again, Joseph looked to God. God blessed him. And the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. So once again, we find Joseph not quitting when others let him down. And God prospered him once again. He was given responsibility of keeper of the prison. Now in the process of time, we know the story. Pharaoh becomes upset with two of his officers, chief butler and a chief baker. And having these two dreams in chapter 40, Jacob was told them, and he said to them, we have each had a dream. They said to Joseph, they had this dream and they wanted to know the interpretation. We each have had a dream. There's no interpreter of it. And Joseph said, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. So with God's help, Joseph interprets the dreams. But then Joseph asks a favor from one of these individuals, the chief butler. And in verse 14, but remember me, Joseph says, when it's well with you, once you're released and you're restored to your status as chief butler, please show me kindness. Please make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house, for indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and I've done nothing here that they should put me into this dungeon. Remember me, Joseph declares. Mention me to Pharaoh when you get out. I've helped you out, now help me out. And in verse 21-22, he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, just as Joseph had interpreted the dreams. He placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand, and he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph also had interpreted to them. But notice in verse 23, yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So the chief butler let Joseph down. First it was the father, then his brothers. He had a bad experience when his mom died. He went to Egypt. Potiphar let him down. Potiphar's wife let him down. The chief butler let him down. So here we find another person who disappointed Joseph. And he could have just quit there. He could have just quit or camped. But he decided to climb. And we know the story. 2 years later, there was a famine in the land. And Pharaoh had a dream. And there was going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years or a famine first, and then or 7 years of plenty, then famine. And so he chose Joseph to orchestrate saving all this food back, which turned out to be very, very good. In spite of the obstacles, Joseph continued the climb. He continued the ascent. But Joseph had a lot of adversity. Again, his mom died, his family limbs down, his friends, other people around him. What about you? When others let you down, what do? Will you quit? Will you climb? Or do we just settle and camp? What will be our attitude? Every place that Joseph went, he prospered. And there's two primary reasons for this. First of all, you obey God. When we obey God, we always come out ahead. And God blessed him. But secondly, he was blessed because he continued to endure. He continued to deal with the adversity that he found himself in around him. He chose to climb, and it fared well with him. And eventually his household, when they showed up years later to get food down in Egypt. But God bless his effort. Proverbs 13 and verse 4, I'll just reference that. Proverbs 13 and verse 4, the soul of the lazy man desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. You know, many times a diligent man is blessed financially. God has prospered many throughout the years with an abundance of physical goods, but many times, it's the true riches that we're blessed with. We're blessed with the true riches, including peace, satisfaction, contentment, happiness, gratification, serenity. These all come as a byproduct of God's Holy Spirit and God pouring out those blessings upon us. So the first adversity we can encounter is that we can be let down by others. You know, it might be a small disappointment. Maybe someone doesn't return a text or return a phone call to you. Maybe someone betrays your trust and is of a larger nature, how a person may let you down. But do we just throw up our hands and quit? Or do we climb upward? Joseph shook it off and kept climbing. Well, we, like Joseph, need to keep in perspective. When trials and tests come about us, we need to keep it in perspective. You know, all people are imperfect. All people are capable of sin. And all people can let you down in life. So we need to develop a high adversity quotient in our relationships. We need to accept the fact that people are going to let you down sometime or another. From time to time, they're going to let you down. Someone once said that it is far better to learn to deal with the negative than just to be positive. You know, to be positive, that's a great thing. It's great to be positive instead of negative. But it's better yet to be able to deal with the negative. Very important point to consider. Joseph learned how to come back when people knocked him down. Moving on to a second source of adversity. Point number two, adversity can come or stem from circumstances. Adversity can come or stem from circumstances. Sometimes adversity comes from outside circumstances. Let's briefly look at the life of Job over in Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1, within a very brief period of time, Job's life turned upside down. Things were flipped in Job's life so very, very quickly. And his adversity came primarily from outside circumstances. Job 1 in verse 1, there's a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and a man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. So notice the sequence here. He was perfect and upright. He was spiritually rich. He shunned evil. And when Job goes through the trials, that are about to beset him, it's important to notice that Job wasn't a bad person. In fact, he was a friend of God's. But notice, too, that living righteously does not necessarily exempt us from tragedy. So not only was he spiritually rich, if you will, he was also physically rich. Seven sons and seven daughters were born to Job in verse 2, Job 1 in verse 2. Now in verse 3, also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. He was considered quite wealthy. Some have estimated that perhaps his net worth was between $5 and $10 million. I don't know if that's true or not, but he was, as the Bible states, the greatest of all the people of the East. And like Joseph, Job obeyed God. Like Joseph, God prospered Job in all that he did. He was living a good life until circumstances changed. Now, in this case, of course, Satan had a direct role in those circumstances. But all at once, circumstances began to change. Down in verse 14, and the messenger came to Job and said the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside him. When the Sabaeans raided them and took them all away, indeed they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Now, poor Job, he didn't have time to even process this when, while he was still speaking, verse 16, another one came up, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking and not having time to process the first two events, another came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands. They raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And then perhaps the greatest tragedy, definitely the greatest tragedy, while he was yet speaking, said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshipped. Job had an incredible adversity quotient. Now, unlike Joseph, it wasn't the people that let Job down. Chances are his servants did what they could before they were massacred by the foreigners. The fire from heaven came down, and it was not due to any of his friends. It wasn't the fault of his family that he lost his 7 sons and 3 daughters. But you can't help but admire the adversity quotient that Job had. You know, there's nothing tougher than losing a child. And to lose them all at once had to be heartbreaking to Job. In all this, Job didn't sin or blame God. In verse 21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed is the name of the Lord." But Satan wasn't through yet. He made the claim that the reason Job hadn't sinned or hadn't turned on him was because God hadn't touched his health. And so God gives permission for Satan to personally afflict Job in verse 6, but not to take his life. And in verse 7, Satan went down from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. So we find Job lost all of his servants. He lost his livelihood. Now he was in excruciating pain. And to top it off, now comes along Mrs. Job. Now, in fairness, Mrs. Job also had experienced that. She had lost all her livelihood. She had just lost her 10 children as well. And now she's headed down the path of possibly losing her husband, Job, because he's got these tremendous boils and probably looked pretty pathetic at that time. So now she's headed down that path, but she didn't have the adversity quotient that Job had. Notice in verse 9, his wife said to Job, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." And he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not also accept adversity?" And in this, Job did not sin with his lips. You know, adversity doesn't always bring out the best in people. Some become embittered. Some seek out temporary relief through drugs or alcohol. Some lash out at others and try to blame others for the bad things that are going on in his life. And perhaps this was the line of reasoning of Mrs. Job, finding someone to blame. But notice that adversity from all the circumstances that came didn't break Job. And like Joseph, he begins to acquire even more adversity from his remaining friends and his families. Job's friends were no comfort. They gave him poor counsel. And yet in the New Testament, James chapter 5, you can read this. James chapter 5, and verse 11. "Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." You know, Job had great endurance and patience. He had a high adversity quotient, a high AQ. Notice that in verse 11, the latter part, "the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." You know, God doesn't cause suffering to people. He allows suffering to happen to us. He allows all the tragedies that we see around the world today, like the shooting again in California or the wildfires that was mentioned going on in Queensland over in Australia. But in and out of the church, this whole world is yearning for a better time to come. We are yearning for God's kingdom to come. The world, I have to assume, after seeing all the political battles that go on, is yearning for a better time as well. They don't know what to be yearning for. They just hope that things change in this world. We understand that's not going to happen apart from God. But in Job's case, it was Satan who instituted the adversity. Let's notice a passage in Hebrews chapter 12, something to keep in mind. Hebrews 12 and verse 5, "For you have forgot just the previous book." Hebrews 12 and verse 5, "For you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son he receives. For if you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten?" You know, sometimes God does chasten us. Sometimes God has to correct us. He allows things to happen in our lives to build that holy and righteous character, to make us more complete, if you will. But many times suffering comes from sin. Most of the time suffering comes from sin. you know, God's not responsible when you lose your temper and you lash out at your boss and you lose your job. You know, God's not responsible when an alcoholic loses his family, when a chain smoker gets cancer, or a promiscuous person gets AIDS. These are problems of our own making. Sometimes our suffering is of our own doing. You know, we live in a contaminated world. There are crooks, there are thieves, there are a number of selfish people around us, and I don't have to convince you of that, I'm sure. And of course, we have an adversary who contributes to our adversity quotient. Satan tempts us so that we do fall down. But God allows many tests to come upon us, to try us, to test us, to demonstrate our faith. In most cases, God is not the author, but God can use suffering for His benefit. We usually object to suffering because we can't see how suffering is going to benefit us. We're usually opposed to suffering because it doesn't make sense to us sometimes. How is this going to be an advantage to me? How can this suffering benefit me? You know, Romans 8 and verse 28 is an encouraging verse, but there's a key element sometimes that we miss. Romans 8 and verse 28, I'll just read that to you. We know that all things work together for the good, for those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. Called according to God's purpose. God allows us to suffer for His glory. God will bless those who do not quit. God will bless those who persevere. Our trials, as hard as they are good for us in the end. I know it's hard to imagine that as we're going through those, but our trials shape us and they mold us. I'll just read Romans 5, save a little time here. Romans 5, verses 3 to 5, and not only that, but we glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulations produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Now hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which was given to us. Romans 5, verses 3 to 5. Psalm 119, in verse 71, it is good for me that I've been afflicted. Why? That I may learn your statutes. Psalmist records, it's good that I've been afflicted. By being afflicted, I can learn your way of life more fully. I can internalize it. But just as with Joseph, things turned out well for Job. He restored twice as much livestock than he had before. He gave him another 10 children, as you can read over in Job chapter 42. And I'm just going to skip this section since I'm running a little bit behind here. But Job lived for another 140 years. He saw his children grow up, as well as his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, up to four generations. So we find here in the book of Job that he had a great adversity quotient. He had the ability to deal with adversity. And because of that, Joseph prevailed. So we're up to point three now. First of all, adversity comes in the form of disappointments from people. People let you down. The second form of adversity comes from without. It comes from circumstances that come upon us in this life. But both Job and Joseph had high adversity quotients. They weren't quitters. They weren't campers. Instead, they were climbers, and they continued to push upward and onward in spite of what they faced. So a third source of adversity is this. Adversity can come from within. Adversity can come from within. What happens when we make big mistakes of our own choosing? What happens when we really blow it and we have no good excuse? You know, we become weak, we become tempted. We knew better, but we blew it. We made the wrong choice. We hurt ourselves or we hurt someone else in the process or both. What happens when we have adversity that's self-afflicted? It's not someone else's fault. It didn't come from circumstances. It came by our choices. We made the wrong choices. It's squarely our fault. We caused our marriage to fail. We blew thousands of dollars. We did something foolish to lose our job. We got careless and got in an automobile accident. We lost our temper and we abused the people we love. You took something that didn't belong to you. We made disastrous mistakes. But what do we do about it? Do we let it ruin the rest of our lives? Or do we bounce back? How do we handle the adversity that comes upon us that has been our own making? When the weather gets nasty, do we just go back down the mountain or do we continue to climb? Sometimes we just need to take a deep breath and continue to climb. But Christians need to develop the mental and the spiritual toughness to keep climbing, even though when we slip and we hurt ourselves. Dr. Stultz uses the acronym CORE to list four dimensions of adversity quotient. There's four different components of this. And on page 107, so we're going to spell out the word CORE. The first C, or the only C, I guess, C stands for control. It asks the questions, how much control do you perceive that you have over adverse event? Notice the key word here is perceive. Actual control in a given circumstance or situation is nearly impossible to measure. Perceived control is far more important. Then on page 108, it's difficult to overestimate the power of perceived control. Without it, hope and action are crushed. With it, lives can be transformed and destinies fulfilled. Those with higher AQs, he continues to write at the bottom of page 108, those with higher AQs simply perceive greater control over life's events than do those with lower AQs. As a result, they take action, which results in more control. When we perceive we have control, then we actually have some control. We do things that actually brings control to us. So those with higher AQs are more likely to climb, whereas those with lower AQs are more likely to camp or quit. The self-fulfilling prophecy is true. So as a result, they take action, which gives them more control. Then on page 109, those who score low in the C dimension might think, oh, this is out of my reach. There's nothing I can do about it. Oh, well, there's no just use banging your head against the wall. You can't fight City Hall. Whereas those with higher IQ says, woo, this is tough, but I've seen tougher. There must be something I can do. I refuse to believe I'm helpless in this situation. There's always a way. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. I've got to figure out a way. Notice the difference in thinking. High AQ people are relatively immunized from feeling helpless. It's as they're protected by this impenetrable force field that keeps them from bottomless despair. Perceiving even the smallest degree of control has a radical and powerful effect on the actions and the thoughts that follow. You know, you always have control of situations to some degree. You can always control your response to a situation. You always have that control. How can I respond to a certain stimulus? We have control of our attitude. This is the seed in which hope and action is sprout. But from our perspective as Christians, we should understand and realize that even though we may not have full control of a situation, God is always in control, even when we are not. God's always in control. This is hope. This is what we read back in Romans chapter 5. Now, the O in core, again, we're spelling out C-O-R-E, stands for origin and ownership. What's the origin of the adversity, and what degree do I own the outcome of the adversity? People with a low AQ tend to place undue blame on themselves, totally. Now, blaming's not all bad. It helps you to learn. If you blame yourself, it's highly likely that you will learn and adjust your behavior. Blame leads to remorse and reconciliation. When we do something awful to someone, for instance, it's good that we experience remorse. So remorse and self-blame is not bad. It's the right first step, but it has to be in measured doses. Too much blame and remorse is demoralizing. Blame and remorse in a right measure leads to action. But blame overdone creates inaction. I'm just going to reference 2 Corinthians 7. Talks about sorrow, godly sorrow leading to repentance, which leads to salvation. It leads to no regret. Worldly sorrow leads to death. Godly sorrow leads to earnestness. In 2 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, so for your notes. It leads to an eagerness to clear yourself, as the scripture points out. Indignation, alarm, longing, concern, readiness to see justice done. At every point, you have proved yourself to be clear or innocent in this matter, Paul brings out there in Corinthians. You know, Judas Iscariot betrayed Christ. He felt remorse, but it was the wrong type of remorse. It was overdone. It led to him hanging himself. He could have controlled his response. Judas could have owned up to his sin. He could have come back to Christ and repented and been forgiven and restored, but he had the wrong kind of blame. People with low ownership tend to think, it's all my fault. I'm such an idiot. I should have known better. What was I thinking? I'm just a failure. People with a higher origin have a tendency to see other characteristics of the adversity, and they put their own role into perspective. I made a mistake, but it's lousy timing. I made a mistake, but I've been overburdening myself. No one could see this coming. You're rarely 100% at fault. And people with a higher AQ do a better job of keeping their own role into perspective. On page 114, Dr. Stoltz writes, remember, self-blame is important and effective to a point. To a point. Excessive self-blame, however, that goes beyond one's role in causing the adversity is destructive. Of far greater importance is what degree are you willing to own the outcome of the adversity. Blame is not the same as accountability. Owning the outcome reflects accountability, and that's the second half of the O2, ownership, and what is the origin and ownership, I should say. So people with low adversity quotient will blame themselves and they end up owning nothing. They must own the outcome. Now the R in CORE, C-O-R, R stands for reach. How far will the adversity reach into other areas of one's life? You know, if you get a ticket on the way to work, does it mess up your whole day? If your boss makes you mad, you know, do you make your coworkers mad? You go home and take it out on the wife or the dog or the cat or whatever. On page 120, the R dimension, Dr. Stoltz writes, asks the question, how far will the adversity reach into other areas of my life? Lower AQ responses allow the adversity to bleed over to other facets of one life. A bad meeting becomes a ruined day. A conflict becomes a failed relationship. A negative performance appraisal becomes a career failure, which causes financial panic, sleeplessness, bitterness, distancing one from another, and poor decision making. Indeed, the lower your R score, again standing for reach, the more likely you are to catastrophize bad events, allowing them to spread, consuming your happiness and your peace of mind in the process. Catastrophizing, like wildfire, can be dangerous. It can cause significant damage if it's left unchecked. On the other hand, the higher your R score is, the more you may have to limit the reach of the problems to the event at hand. A cold call rejection is just one rejection, nothing more, nothing less. A tough performance appraisal is a tough performance appraisal. You know, a conflict is a conflict, an event that may warrant additional commitment and action. A misunderstanding with a loved one, although painful, is a misunderstanding with a loved one, not a sign that your life is falling apart. So people with lower AQ scores will be overdramatic in their reaction. You know, the sky is falling, the end is coming. But people with higher AQ scores are inclined to limit the adversity for what it is. They just reach into the event at hand. You know, I bounced a check, but I'm going to make it right. I had a poor performance review, but I'm going to do better next time. You know, work extra hard and it won't happen again. We have to trust that God has providence over our lives. We can't let specific events dominate and reach into the other areas of our lives. Then page 122, limiting the reach of the adversity is highly desirable. The further you allow the adversity to reach into the other areas of your life, the more helpless and overwhelmed you may feel. Small annoyances can become disasters if allowed to fester and grow in the fertile darkness of your subconscious. Limiting the reach of your adversity enables you to think clearly and to take action. Allowing even a moderate reach of the adversity into one or more areas of your life can take the strength out of your climbing legs. And then finally, the E in CORE stands for endurance. The final dimension of your AQ is E. Again, we spell that C-O-R-E. It asks two related questions. How long will the adversity last, and how long will the cause of the adversity last? You know, the lower your E score, the more likely you are to perceive adversity and its causes lasting a long time, if not forever. You know, this always happens. These are, you know, things will never get better. These are low E scores. I'm not good with computers. It's always been this way. My life is run. My company is doomed. My boss is right. I'm not wired for success. The whole industry is going down the tube. My family will never be close. I'll never be a good salesperson. No one will want to marry me. I've always been lazy. I've never been good with kids. I'm just a procrastinator. I have no willpower. All of these statements reek of performance. Labels such as loser, stupid, failure, procrastinator, as well as words like always and never, are insidious, writes Dr. Stoltz. They render you helpless to change. There's a world of difference between I need to be careful not to postpone things to the last moment, as opposed to I'm a procrastinator. I need to be careful to postpone things to the last moment. It's providing some kind of action and preventative stuff that you can do ahead of time. Over in Mark chapter 14, I gave this in Henderson, and I cut out a bunch of stuff, and I'm still at the end of my sermon with so much more to talk about. Mark chapter 14, though, Peter comes across a instance where he says that he won't deny Christ. I'm just going to summarize it here. As we know the story, Peter said, you know, Christ told him they were all going to be scattered, and Peter said, we will never leave you or forsake you. And then Christ tells Peter that before the rooster crows twice, you're going to deny me three times. And that did happen. Sometimes people tend to underestimate certain abilities of oneself while overestimating other abilities. You know, they continue to underestimate their ability to cope with adversity. They say, I can never go through this, but they can't. Then again, they underestimate their ability to deal with temptation. They say, I can handle that, but they can't. So as we know, Christ denied Christ on three different occasions. But John chapter 20, in verses 1 to 5, Mark chapter 16, in verses 7, we see that Peter still hung around. Even though he denied Christ, he felt bad. And when Christ was going by, he looked at Peter, and the great fisherman cried because he had let Christ down. But he kept on climbing, and those verses, John 20 and Mark 16, you can find out that Christ didn't give up on Peter. He had a certain invitation to come. You know, Peter could have quit. He could have hunkered down and camped, but he kept on hanging around. He kept on climbing. He didn't let any of his big mistakes reach out and control other areas of his life. He dealt with remorse. He accepted the blame, but he also accepted the ownership. And we find that within 2 months of this event, the very first sermon that was preached on Pentecost was preached by Peter. Peter gave that first sermon. Mistakes are not final. God gives us a second chance. You can get back up when you're falling down. Godly sorrow leads to repentance. He owned up to the situation at hand. So when we confront adversity, what is our AQ? Will we quit? Will we camp? Or will we climb? Remember the acronym CORE, we need to take control of the situation. We need to determine the origin, take ownership of it. We need to not let its reach affect any other area of our life, and we need to endure. We need to keep on keeping on. In the last minute, we need to return into my story at Kauai. As I lay there frustrated, I was reminded of the principles of this book. I decided to keep on climbing. I took one of the fans and I brought in air from the only door that we had open. And then I had another fan in the bathroom that actually blew that cool air. At least we could sleep. And also the fans tend to drown out the roosters. So we ended up being able to sleep. And we had a marvelous time on Hawaii with the air conditioner the next day as we got in the car. But we had a most memorable time in Hawaii. In Kauai. So when adversity comes, be a climber. continue to climb upward and onward. Ask God to help us have a greater AQ in our lives, to overcome life's obstacles, to move on to the next phase, to take on the next steps, to be able to cope with adversity. We can never afford to let our eyes off the go. We can never afford to give up on the road to eternal life. Whatever comes our way, we must learn to weather the storms. If we're ever going to see a rainbow, you got to learn to stand a little rain.